You're listening to Bedroom Beethovens, where notable music makers break down stories accompanied by songs and melodies documenting growth through their 10,000-hour journey. And me? Well, my name is Cello, your host.
I am a bedroom Beethoven.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 86 of the Bedroom Beethovens podcast.
When it comes to being true, at least true to me, one thing I found, oh no, you never let me down.
My guest this week is...
My name is Jay Ivey, poet, spoken word artist from Chicago. My work has spanned from HBO Deaf Poetry to working with Kanye and Jay-Z and John Legend, Cootie and Chike, Deepak Chopra, Michael Jordan, NBA, on and on, on and on. Tari Ture, and on and on, yeah.
And you slipped off the side and clenched onto your life in my grip. I would never, ever let you down. And when these words are found, let it be known that God's penmanship has been signed with a language called love. That's why my breath is felt by the deaf, and why my words are heard and confined to the ears of the blind. I too dream in color and in rhyme, so I guess I'm one of a kind in a full house. Cause whenever I open my heart, my soul, or my mouth, a touch of God reigns out.
Take them to church. Poetry started as spoken word poetry. People think spoken word is new because it has hip-hop associations, but spoken word is an ancient form. The whole idea of looking inside, the truth that comes out, that's the practice that young people need to revisit, and poetry promotes that. Rap is a great expression, but inside the anger is limited, and the response to the anger is stronger. The recognition of blessings are always inside. Poetry is uplifting, deeply spiritual, and that's something that we lost. At least in my opinion, and as poetry becomes more popular, it creates visionaries. Now, when you were in high school, and your teacher kind of forced you to do a show, usually when you get put into that situation like that, or it stems from a reluctancy, it doesn't end in a standing ovation. And that tells you a lot about the character of a man, in my opinion. That's the character of Jay Ivey. And I hear people say silence is violence, but we've been protesting George Floyd for months. And this month, a black man gets shot in his back 7 times in front of his kids. And I have to ask myself, what are we doing to get to a space and time where we're not seeing these tragedies occur over and over again? Is looting storefronts and convicting the cops causing these tragedies and making signs and letting people know how we feel walking down the streets up and down the be-all, end-all? What are we doing to get to a space and time where we're not seeing these tragedies occur over and over again? Well, they may say Bob Marley isn't the answer. They may say Gil Scott-Heron isn't the answer. They may even say that Jay Ivey isn't the answer. But I believe that music needs to continue to be a focus because music is oftentimes the quickest way to get any message across to a large mass of people. My sit down with Jay Ivey was a most beneficial one, and his new album Catching Dreams is out now. But before we deep dive into the conversation, I just want to tell you guys, TheBedroomBeethovens.com is the website for the podcast where it has information on episodes, social media, and the Patreon to help donate to the show, boost the algorithm so more people get exposed to the show, and I can keep the show growing, ad-free, and at the same time reward you guys for showing your love. So episode 86 with Jay Ivey, the man of the hour. Well, let me ask you, I go on your Twitter, and on any given day, 16 years later, yo, Jay Ivey, your verse on Never Let Me Down, it's so poetic, it's so soulful, you're the man. And like, you know, I saw an interview with Russell Crowe, because he was promoting a new movie this week, and he said people still come up to him and quote Gladiator, you know, are you not entertained? And depending on who you are, you can be a good sport about it, or you can be like, ah, come on, man, I've accomplished so much more since then. You know, I got a new album this week, and we're still talking about College Dropout. Like, where do you kind of land on that?
Well, now I love it. I've always loved it, but there was a brief spell of time where I had that feeling. I had that, man, I'm more than just that. But then I don't know. I think I had an epiphany one day. It's like, yo, like, man, thank God you have something that everybody knows, and that will, you know, open a door to the rest of your work and expose them to the rest of what you do. So, man, I love it, man. It's a blessing. People come up to me with sending me pictures of tattoos and with my words on their arms. And I'm like, yo, this is wild. So, yeah, I love it. I love it.
Yeah, that's a good attitude, because not only was it an important moment for you, like you said, but I think it's important for people to realize that those opportunities, they don't just happen, right? Like, you're in BK, mm-hmm. you're broke, you're struggling, and you had to, like, impromptu say those lines on the phone over and over and over, impressing everyone in the room to the point where they fly you out and want you to be on it. I mean, if someone called me right now and said, yo, Kanye and Jay want you on a song, I can't sit here and 100% tell you that I could seize that opportunity, whether it's imposter syndrome or nerves. It's a moment that only comes around once in a lifetime, and you either blow it or you excel and own it. And you did that.
Man, it was a blessing, man. Getting that phone call, shout out to Cootie. Of Cootie and Chike. Cootie hit me up when he was in the studio with Kanye. And to get that phone call saying, man, Kanye got this song with him and Jay-Z on it, he want to put a poet on it. And I told him he need to put Jay Ivy on it. I was in Brooklyn, like you said, broke. Like, man, come on, man. And Cootie's a funny guy. He's a funny dude. So I'm like, come on, man. Like, that ain't funny, man. Stop playing. He's like, nah, you need to get here tomorrow if you can. I was like, tomorrow? Oh, you for real? So yeah, man, like, having those moments, what I learned from that and other moments, you know, be prepared. Be prepared. Believe in yourself. Do you. You know, just do you. So that moment, it was really a matter of me doing me and being confident that I could deliver. And man, thank God it worked out.
And because of that song, you have a writing credit next to Michael Bolton and Kiss.
I know, right? That's crazy. Yeah, man, it's wild. It's wild. Like the whole experience, it was so surreal. It was like a movie. It was a movie. Like, you know, they flew me out. I got the call Saturday night. So, you know, like you said, I spit the poem. I did that poem for like a half hour and a minute. The piece is a minute long. And Cootie got back on the phone. He was like, man, Kanye flying you out here tomorrow. I was like, wow, I found my way. So the next day was Sunday, and the offices, Def Jam, was closed on Sunday. So I had to wait till Monday. Monday morning, they calling me up. They like, what's your government name? All right, we booking your flight. We sending a car at this time. Be ready. All right, cool. And then I fly out to L.A., get there. And when I touched down, Kanye and Cootie, they were all at the Improv, because D-Ray, he hosts at the Improv every Monday. Been doing it for years. He still does it. This is back in 2002. So the car takes me to the Improv. D-Ray puts me on the mic, so I ended up performing at the Improv, and then we leave there, go to the studio. We did like 10 minutes. Janet Jackson's upstairs recording, Earth, Wind, and Fire down the hall recording, Maya across the hall recording, and then Kanye was like, yo, you ready? I was like, yeah. It's like, yeah. Like, yeah, I just flew, performed, yeah, I'm ready. You know, so flew from New York at that. And man, I hopped in a booth, but to hear Jay-Z's voice, because, you know, before this, I was just hearing it over the phone. So to hear his voice and to hear his verse and to hear Kanye's verse and to hear the hook, man, it was a movie. It felt like a movie. And then that same night, I meet John Stevens, and, you know, that's when I heard his music and I started calling him John Legend, and it stuck. Then I meet Janet Jackson in the hallway. It was so crazy. Like, it was an amazing night.
So you and Cootie, before he was a filmmaker, he wanted to be a comedian, and he was on Def Comedy Jam. Is that how you guys met? Because you were on Def Poetry, and then there was an overlap?
Well, no. Well, he was actually on Comic View, on BET Comic View. So, but we did, the overlap came from being on the Chicago scene. I was young when I first hit the scene. I was like 19, just trying to get into any spot I could to perform. And man, here come Cootie calling me right now. But the angel, because he blessed me, boy. So, but he was doing, you know, he was one of the up and coming comedians, like Deion Cole and D. Ray and Damon Williams and Lil Rel. These were some of the comedians at the time that were coming up. So I would go to the comedy club to do poetry. So I got cool with all the comedians from being in the mix at the comedy club. So later on, when I go to do deaf poetry, Cootie at that time had moved to New York and just happened to be at the taping. And him and John Monopoly and a few other folk from Chicago, they were like, man, you own this? I was like, yeah. They was like, man, we sitting in the front row, Chicago style. When I walked out on that stage, the whole front row to my left was all Chicago. All Chicago. So from there, me and Cootie just started, you know, we started building this friendship. We were cool in Chicago, but in New York, we really started building this brotherhood.
Dope, man. Yeah, last year, Kanye bought John Monopoly a Lamborghini on his birthday. So, Jay, come March, maybe look on your driveway. You never know. You never know.
Hey, I'm a look.
And what I also thought, funny. So you grew up disliking your middle name, and Jay-Z, a guy that you won Grammy Awards with, he named his daughter the same name. So it can't be that bad.
Yeah, it can't be. Shout out to my moms, because, yeah, I hated my middle name. Man, you did your research, man. That's like, that's what's up. Yeah, my mom's, when I was in college, I would send my poetry home to my mom's because I'm doing stuff around campus. I'm at the Illinois State University, so I would do stuff around campus. Or if I would write something, I would call people up and be like, man, what you think it is? And, man, listen to this. So with my mom's, I would send poetry home. I would mail her envelopes of poetry. And then one day she called me and she was like, you know what? She's like, I've been thinking. She's like, you should use Ivy as your pen name. She's like, all great poets have a pen name. I was like, yeah, all great poets. So, you know, so I started using my middle name. And I hated it before that because I thought it was a girl's name. But I'm a junior. I'm named after my father. But, you know, I was like, nah, I can't let the fellas know my name is Ivy. Then, you know, so then when I started using when my mom gave me that comment, I was like, yeah. So I started using my full name. And then eventually I just shortened it.
It's fitting because in 1984, the very first Poetry Slam took place in Chicago. So you're very fortunate to be in the birthplace of what you do for a living.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, shout out to Mark Smith. Mark Smith started the Poetry Slams. I was never really a slam poet. I've only done, man, my lifetime, I've probably done like 3 slams. And that's attributed to my English teacher in high school, who was Miss Argue, who's the reason I started performing. And Miss Argue, I always tell people, you know, you're not gonna argue with somebody named Miss Argue.
No doubt, yeah.
So she had us write a poem for homework, and then the next day she surprises the class and makes everybody read their poem in front of the class. And then after class, she pulls me to the side, gives me an A on the poem. I wouldn't get no A's or B's. And she was like, you have a nice speaking voice. I had a show coming up. I want to put you in the show. I didn't do the show. And then she approached me again a few weeks later. She said, you know what? Last time I asked you to do the show, you faked me out. I got another show. This time I'm not asking you. You have to do it. So she makes me do the show. First time on stage, I get a standing ovation. So I'm like, Ms. Argy, when's the next show? When's the next show? So around that time, I remember her telling me, she said, when it comes to poetry, you know, poetry comes from the heart. She's like, how can I judge that? I can't, you know, how can I grade your heart? And I always took that to heart. I always remembered that. And so when it came to slams, I just always felt some kind of way about individuals that I didn't know sitting behind a table, putting up scorecards on my heart. I just felt funny about you scoring my heart. You know what I mean? Like, it just didn't. I know everybody's gonna like what they like and don't like, you know, and they feel what they feel. But seeing scorecards just didn't feel right to me. So I've only done a few in my day, but man, any mic, any like open mics and any stages, colleges, man, any stage I could find, I would hit it. And the few slams I did it because of that. Like I did a few slams in Philly. I was like, well, that'd be a great way for me to get to Philly. I don't care about the judges. I just want to go rock for them.
Well, I remember like, so, you know, that was a great time in your life where Miss Argue kind of pushed you. And because of gentrification, Rich Central High School is now Rich Central STEM Campus High School.
So it's
good for them. But, you know, growing up south side of Chicago as a kid, before transitioning to the suburbs, is it like everyone says in the rap song?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Chicago is, man, it is. I've been to, you know, a lot of cities and definitely, you know, everybody has their hoods. And I'm not discounting anybody on you know, the danger that exists and the risk that we take stepping out the door. But Chicago, it just felt like man, it was just like on another level with it. First of all, Chicago's is they call it hyper segregation. It's the Chicago and Boston are the most segregated cities in the nation. So you really, really live in these black bubbles. When I was growing up on the South Side, everybody was black except the cops. Like everybody, the mailman, the lady at the corner store, all your teachers, all your neighbors, like everybody was black. To the point where this tripped me out, but like maybe a couple years ago, I was just reflecting back to childhood and it dawned on me that we used to say, oh, we going to ride our bikes in the white neighborhood. And that was just a common phrase, like we're going to the white neighborhood. And it hit me one day, like, wow, we actually would call that that's how segregated it was, because that's where all the white folks, when you cross a certain street, it's all white. You cross a certain avenue, it's all Mexican. Cross another, you know, whatever area you were in, it was all that. It was all that. So, you know, the crack era hit and Jordans became, you know, we had Jordan, and Jordans was popular, and Starter Coats were popular. So folks was getting robbed and shot for they Jordans and Starter Coats. So even in this, when we lived in the city, moms was like, nah, you can't have no Jordans. So I didn't have a pair of Jordans until I was grown, until I could buy my own, because she refused to buy them in the city. And then after that, she was like, them things cost too much. But Starter Coats, people were getting shot for them. People died for they Starter Coats and Jordans. And people would jump you into gangs. And it was always a constant threat of, you know, you had gangs on one end, you had the cops on one end, and your job was to get home safe. That was your number one job.
Well, there's a track on the new album called Finding Home in Rwanda, which you personally went to. And from your observation, comparing Rwanda to, let's say, South Side of Chicago, there's crime in both places, but crime in Rwanda is rarely violent. Why is that? What is it about Chicago? Is it the government? Is it the white cop, the black population ratio? Is it the people? Is it the $5 gas? Is it unemployment rates? What do you think it is?
I think it's a combination of it all. I think it's coming from the South. I have a quote in a song says, we're the descendants of survivors that decided to dance in the rain and say, look at me shine. But we are descendants of those, especially like Chicago has mostly Mississippi roots. My pops is from Mississippi. My wife's father is from Mississippi. My grandfather, Mississippi, you know, a majority of black folk in Chicago has some kind of Southern ties. And if it's not Mississippi, it might be Louisiana or Arkansas, but folk just shot straight up. So you're dealing with, you know, we still have the remnants of that slave mentality of being beat down, of dealing with the lack of opportunity, not being in sustainable economic situations. Then you have drugs, you have, you know, the education system where our neighborhoods aren't being afforded the finances they need to have sustainable high education, where we're getting the best books and the teachers aren't overwhelmed and they don't have 30 kids in the classroom. And so, it's a lot of different things. I think that then there's the segregation and the racism and the redlining. So you have all these different situations, I think, that add to the tension. I always say when I notice it when I move, but like when I would go to New York, I felt it was electric. I could feel the energy. When I would go down south, if you know, you feel that southern hospitality. Go to LA, like, man, it's beautiful, but it's something, you know, something in the air, you know, something different here. But Chicago, whenever I would come home after being away, I would feel tension as soon as I would step in the city. But yeah, but going to Rwanda, I feel like everyone has had their had their hard times, and going to Rwanda and hearing the history of the genocide that took place there, and seeing all of the lives lost. I know everybody knows Hotel Rwanda, but to be on the ground and to have those conversations and to see that since that time, which wasn't that long ago, it was only 20 plus years ago, where the height of it took place, and to see how they turn crime around, like they down, that crime is like 2%, and the 2% is pickpocketing.
You were a victim of that.
Yeah, man, you heard about that, huh? Yes. Yeah, like, you know, that was why I couldn't believe that.
Didn't they take your phone? I think they took your phone, right?
Yeah, they got my phone, man. They got my phone. I couldn't believe it, man. We were having an amazing time. Took my phone. We actually had this performance. So we went out there to work with a group of kids, work at this school. We built a playground and did murals. I did a poetry workshop. And then at the end of the week, we did a performance in the city in Kigali, which is the capital, which is, you know, where Hotel Rwanda took place. And after the performance, which was absolutely amazing, so many amazing poets and singers and dancers and musicians came out, and it was beautiful, MCs. So then we go out to kick it and celebrate. And I just got loose for like 1 second. I remember having my hand on my pocket, just being conscious of it, of my phone. And then I saw this girl who performed at the event, and she was standing with one of our guys who helped us build the playground. So I stopped, took my hand off my pocket. I give her a hug. I give him a pound. And then, like, man, and I just felt, I was like, man, I feel like something missing. And I started patting my pockets. I didn't feel nobody brushed up against me, none of that. I was like, yo, my phone. Crazy thing is, the next day I got it back.
There you go.
Yeah, that was an adventure getting back, because we had told the security at the hotel. He's like, no, not in our country. We do not do that. We do not do that here. We're going to get your phone back. I was like, all right, there's a million plus people here. I don't know how you're going to get my phone back. But I believe you. Yeah, but lo and behold, man, next day, it ended up being some shorties. They started calling the phone, because like we were calling the phone, and they responded. We ended up going to hook up with them, and it was like a deep cover mission. It was like we had two guys was on one side of the block and two guys on the other side of the block. And I'm out here with one of my homegirls who was, she was translating. So we waiting in the middle of the street, and then, man, this little kid walks up like, you looking for your phone? I said, come on, man. I mean, he had to be like 14, 15.
Here's, and maybe you can shed some light on the reality of another situation. Cause like, now that I know where you come from and kind of a little bit of what you've been through, you know, Deaf Poetry, Grammys, Peabody, Clio, Telly, NAACP, Image Awards. You gave John Legend his name, self-published books. You're on the Grammy board, Chicago chapter. You got to show the word. And yet during the quarantine, you found yourself to be a quote unquote unemployed artist. And I'm this naive guy where I'm thinking, well, Jay Ivey can just get his cell phone that he recovered, and he's just a few beeps and boops away from calling John Legend or Slick Rick.
The reality of the situation is the climb never stops. You know, the fight, it never stops. So even in the height of quarantine, it was definitely shocking. It was stressful. It was, what the hell we gonna do? How we gonna make money? What, like, it, you know, because the year was looking very promising. 2020 was, oh man, it was off to fun times. We got nominated for Image Awards. I'm at the Image Awards. All-Star Weekend was in Chicago, doing stuff with the Grammys. I'm the president of the Chicago chapter for the Recording Academy. So there's a lot going on with the Grammys. So things, you know, work leading up to releasing the album and going on tour. And Tari Teray, who's my wife, we finished her album, so, which is incredible too. And we like, okay, we're gonna put these albums out, go on tour. And so things were looking really good. And yeah, it all just came to a halt. And what it taught me was it was a great reminder of just being an artist, being an entrepreneur. It you're always figuring it out. There is an art to being there's an art to creating opportunity. And after we got past the initial shock and just buckled down, it was like, okay, let's figure this out. First things first, we need to be able to record. Okay, before they shut all these stores down, we need to run a guitar center. Even though we don't have no money coming in, we need to go go get what we need to be able to record, because that's livelihood. What if a job come in, but somebody want me to do a voiceover, and the studios are closed, and I can't do a job? Man, that wouldn't be good. So we just went into mode like, okay, how can we perform from home? All right, let's get this program and do this and get these lights, and all right, let's figure it out. And I guess the biggest reminder was just to keep moving, even though you're in one location, the movement doesn't stop. Like, just keep moving. It's not, all right, we just go sit here Netflix and chill for the next 3 months. Like, no, like we got to keep moving. And then when it comes to those big, you know, those friendships and those relationships with big artists, I don't know if it's pride or ego or any, but I'm never like, I want to work for mine. You know, that's always been me. I want to work for what I do. So I've never been one to say, yo, I need, man, can you? Now, if you need me to do some work, like, yeah, man. Like, I was in the studio with Kanye last year working on Jesus Is King. I was in the studio with him for about a week. None of what I did made the album, but here I am, man, happy to work, happy to lend my services, my thoughts, my ideas. I'm going to record some verses. I'm gonna put in that work happily. You know, thank God I do something I love to do. But the key is to never stop moving. That's been the biggest lesson in all of this.
Yeah, because you weren't just guest appearing on people's songs. Like, a year after College Dropout came out, I feel like you created, I don't want to say trend, because I think that's too weak of a word, but Common dropped the corner with The Last Poets. Mm. And I mean, from a hip hop fan's perspective, the reason why rappers are incorporating The Last Poets and spoken word, that's you. You know what I'm saying? You had that influence on Good Music. They were trying to continue incorporating poetry into hip hop. I mean, and when you win a Grammy for something, it's hard not to try to do it again and again and again.
Yeah, well, I'll say this. I feel like I'm a part of a lineage. I was continuing to do what the Roots did with Ursula Rucker at the, you know, on the end of their albums, where they will always feature Ursula Rucker. And then continuing, you know, with starting Long Ago with The Last Poets and Gil Scott-Heron. So poetry and music has always been tied together.
I charge my heart, I monument, I testimonial to freedom, to peace, and to love down on the corner.
Yes, it has been done before, and I was a part of continuing to be something that's been done, but I was also blessed to be on one of the all-time greatest hip-hop albums. Like, to have that moment on one of the all-time greatest albums, like, that was special. Matter of fact, when I was in, speaking of finding home in Rwanda, when I was in Rwanda, that record came to be because while I was there, we went to a club, and at the club, a friend introduced us to this guy named One Key. She's like, I have a friend of mine, he wants to meet one of you all. introduced him to a guy, Can B. One Key, this Can B. One Key, this is Tari Teray. One Key, this is J.I.V.E. J.I.V.E., oh my God, like I would never, ever let you down, J.I.V.E. I was like, yeah, I'm in Africa. I'm in Rwanda. I'm around the world right now. And this brother is showing me love, talking about, man, he's like, man, I started doing poetry because of you. I was like, wow. I'm, you know, tearing up. I'm like, oh my God. So then the brother, man, he turned out to be one of the most incredible poets I've ever heard. Do poetry in 5 different languages. And I mean, it's incredible with the wordplay. So then when I did Find a Home in Rwanda, I had the poem, and one of the artists that he brought to that event that I was saying, you know, at the end of the week, we had that show. One of the artists that he brought was this musician and singer named Munyakazi Deo. So this brother plays this instrument called an Inanga, and he's singing, and oh my God, it was so incredible. So later on, he posted something on Instagram. I was like, man, brother, I'm working on my album. Can you send me something like that? He sends me a track. Then I'm like, well, I can't have a track with you and not have it have One Key on it, because One Key brought us all together. So I reached out to One Key, like, One Key, I got this record with Munyakazi. You want to get on it? He like, absolutely. So that's how Find a Home in Rwanda came to be. And it started with that love from the College Dropout. It started with, oh man, I was inspired by what you did. The same way I was inspired by when somebody first showed me, when I had a counselor at Illinois State, and he was like, man, I see you doing poetry around campus. He was like, man, you need to check this out. And he pulls out Gil Scott Heron's book, So Far, So Good. And then I get to read that book, and it was just moved at the possibility of what I could do with my writing. Like, the way he wrote was, it was so incredible to me. So really, man, I'm just paying it forward, and man, thanking God for everybody that's done it before me, that's done it with me, because there's thousands of incredible poets out here that are just, I mean, incredible artists, incredible, like, jaw-dropping, hair-raising, you know, just electric artists. So I'm super proud to be a part of the poetry family.
Well, I mean, during the Civil Rights Movement, political Black poetry was prominent. It was used to heal. It was used to weaponize and combat hate, like you say, Gil Scott Heron. But you're the type of person, like, you can go to another country, people know who you are. So being in the limelight with such a discipline, do you feel a responsibility to speak now, like a responsibility to heal people with your album? It's no coincidence that album is dropping when it's dropping, when Black men are getting shot 7 times in the back in front of their kids. Like, now's the time to heal, to fight back.
Everything happens for a reason, right? And when I look at who I come from, my father, he was a DJ. He uses his voice. I would listen to my pops on the radio before I walked to school in the morning. And my mother was a nurse. She was a registered nurse and worked with in a dialysis unit with diabetic patients, and used to work at Cook County Hospital with the show ER was based on. So I always looked at them like, oh, I'm a combination of these two people. So it's on me to use my voice to help heal people.
From Chi-Town to Ghana, we do it with honor. So remember who I am, for I am man made of dust, so I adjust to avoid returning to ashes by creating classics that can't be cremated. I'm elated, birth was belated, an old soul who was meant to come up during these times of the sedated. Relay my father's messages with words, so truth is related, therefore it's love and hated. With voice I'm left to fend for self, I stand armed with arms, I should be tatted with pride and a heart for what's inside. I ride without armor, I can't be conquered.
And that's always been tied in my work. Even when I wasn't necessarily conscious of it, it's always been intertwined in every poem I've ever written. And I've always wanted to, like, just show love, like, lead with love, and, you know, have put smiles on people's faces and have a good time. So with the album, with Catching Dreams was an extension of that. It was, let me use my voice to help heal people, including myself, because I definitely need healing. So it was, all right, I'm gonna write this song. I can't go. I can't go. It's going to be about just not giving up, even though it's hard and we're going through what we're going through. I can't give up. Just personally, I can't give up. Fall don't trip. I might make mistakes, but keep it moving. Man, we forget how blessed we are, you know, how happy we can be. But why do we forget? Maybe we forget because we forget where we come from, man. And I had this moment where I found home. I actually found home. I went back to where we first began, you know. So it's this journey of this experiences of, and a lot of healing is tied into it. I was looking to put the album out in March, but then of course the quarantine hit, and then I didn't want to hold on to it. So I was looking to put it out in May. I think it was around May, June, but then, you know, man, we lost the life of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. So I just didn't feel right about, I felt insensitive about putting out a project in the midst of that. More time went by and it's like really wanted to get out of my own way and say, all right, the album, it needs to be out. Like, hopefully this will be something that can help. So then we set the date and put it out. And then right as it was coming out, Jacob Blake and Chadwick Boseman passes. It's like, oh my God. But, you know, and I felt insensitive from like promoting a project. Like, here, I'm promoting this album. But then at the same time, I know the purpose of the album. I know the intention behind the album. I know that it can heal people in a time in a time where we're hurting, because that was what we poured into. Like, man, maybe this can help. Maybe this project can help.
There's so much going on in the world, and you're dropping an album in the middle of all this. I really want to reiterate that, because that's heavy, and I think people should listen to it and appreciate it, because it's what's needed.
I was put here to use my words to help heal people, and so yeah, it's again me walking in my purpose and leaning on my responsibility, figuring it out, because I can't get out and tour, which is one of the goals, which is a huge stream of income. Is to, okay, we got this project. We put all this money into this, you know, it's an independent effort. There's no label. So we put all this money in because we want to create something great. So in order to create something great, I need to be able to get in tune with friends of mine who are the greatest in the world, you know, whether that be Tari Terrell on vocals or Yao on vocals or Chris Robb on keys or Maurice Brown, the Grammy winning trumpet player, or JT Rich, the incredible producer, Rail, Edith Yokley, all these amazing musicians. Oh my God, Leo Nunez, who produced a joint, Amon Grimes, produced a joint. And I wanted to just create something, this poetry and music that could penetrate people's souls and spirits and just make them feel something. Like we still alive. We gonna be all right. We gonna get through this. We've gotten through way worse. And these are terrible times, but there's balance to that too. Like, these are great times too. So like, let's find the balance, keep pushing forward and make the most of it.
No doubt, man. I'm wishing you massive congrats on the album. It's out now, and everything else going on in your life, the wisdom, the insight, the artistry that you've shared with myself and my podcast is massive. And I appreciate it, man. And I want everyone to know that I commented on a 6-month-old Instagram post and you responded. You're a man of the people.
Oh man, that's love, man. Yeah, I saw the comment. I was like, Devo Spring. Shout out to Devo Springsteen. And yeah, I saw the comment. I was like, oh, that's love, man. And I've always been like that. I've always been like, man, we people. Like, ain't nothing. Like, I'm no better, no worse. Like, we're people, and that's how I'm always moved. So, man, yeah, I appreciate you. You know, reaching back and providing this, because this what you're doing is incredible, and we need more of it. We got to keep telling our story. So, man, salute to you.